So let me introduce Tessa. And so it's an honor to be able to introduce the first international speaker in this series. And Tessa Yuvar-Haley.
Cool.
is a housing rights organizer from Budapest, Hungary. She's currently a fellow with the Kairos Center through the Professional Fellows Program, which is a month-long exchange program sponsored by the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. And those of us, Tessa's been with us for about a week and a half, and those of us who have gotten to spend time with her have already been tremendously inspired by her and the work that she's a part of and have learned much from the movement from which she comes. And so we're excited to have the larger network get a chance to hear from her and ask questions today and make connections between what you're doing and what's going on where you are and what she's doing and what's going on where she's from. So Tessa has been an activist and organizer for housing rights since 2005 when she joined the Man on the Street, which was a grassroots volunteer group in Budapest fighting for the dignity and rights of homeless people. And she brought those experiences, both positive and critical, when she came to the City University of New York for their doctoral program. And she graduated from that with her PhD in 2013 with a dissertation called Injustice in the Streets, The Long Housing Crisis in Hungary, From Above and From Below. So while in New York, she developed a relationship with Picture the Homeless, which is one of the organizations endorsing the call for the Poor People's Campaign for Today. And upon returning to Budapest, in consultation with Picture the Homeless leaders, Tessa was part of launching The City is for All, which quickly became one of the most recognized, effective, and respected movements in Hungary. Seeing the need to expand the political education capacity of the movement, she later launched the School for Public Life, whose main mission is to get citizens to be interested in politics and support groups experiencing oppression to organize their own social movements through education, research, publications, and strategic planning. So I'm excited that today she'll be sharing more about this effort and its lessons for our own work. I'm going to turn it over now.
Great. Thank you, Tessa. Thanks a lot, and thanks for having me, and thanks to all of you for attending. So today I would like to talk about building a housing movement in Hungary, and we did change the title of this presentation from homeless movement to housing movement, and I think you will understand why. And first of all, I would like to give you a very short overview of the housing situation in Hungary. You know, Hungary is in Eastern Europe, but it's part of the European Union. It's kind of on the periphery of the European Union in both social, political, and economic sense. And so in Hungary, there was a shortage of housing. Like, actually, there was not enough housing until the 1970s. And this changed because for what was called state socialism or state capitalism, as others like to call it, housing became a really, really important central issue. And the state invested a lot in housing, and people's housing conditions improved immensely. And this basically put an end to housing shortage. And ever since the 1970s, there are enough housing units in Hungary to house everyone. The issues today are different. It's more an issue of quality of housing and affordability of housing, which I will talk about more. But so up until the 1980s, until the regime changed in 1989, we had a pretty strong centralized housing policy with a lot of support for housing. And this did not mean that there were no homeless people or there weren't people living in really bad conditions, but for the majority of the population, their housing situation did improve. And after 1989, when we transitioned from state socialism to capitalism, basically all of the housing that was owned by the state or developed by the state, it became privatized. So for example, in Budapest, before the regime change, 50% of all housing was state-owned. And today it's around 4 or 5%, or in some districts, 6%. So basically the social housing stock was eliminated, and those people, and today only 2% of the total housing stock is owned by the state or by local housing authorities. And the people who live in those housing units are always the poorest, and the quality of these housing units is really, really low. And another big change that happened after the regime change was that all housing subsidies were basically cut. So housing subsidies were basically reduced to almost zero. And before the regime change, evictions were not legal. After the regime change, evictions became legal, and now thousands and thousands of people are being evicted. So this is a huge change. And it's quite important that housing issues became more visible in Hungary towards the end of the 1980s, so when the system started to collapse economically and politically. And this was due a lot to homeless people who were protesting on train stations. In 1989 and 1990, hundreds of homeless people occupied central train stations in Budapest and central squares in Budapest, and they were demanding housing and jobs. And their demands were only partly met. They didn't get housing, and the state has not had any housing policy for the poor ever since. But a very broad system of homeless shelters and charity organizations have been developed as a response to these protests and occupations. And another important point to remember is that it was not only the housing system that collapsed after the regime change, but also the economic situation of the country. So after 1989, 1.5 million jobs were lost in Hungary. So this is the number of people who became kind of superfluous for the system after the regime change. And of course, in Hungary, the welfare state, which was in place under state socialism, wasn't completely destroyed. So a lot of these people who lost their jobs were kept on the surface through minimal welfare, just basic survival. But it's only survival. And the turning point, which really changed the situation of at least minimal survival, is 2010, when the so-called Fidesz government was elected with 2/3 majority. Fidesz is a right-wing government with a very pro-rich, pro-wealthy agenda. They want to build a very loyal capitalist class for their own political reproduction. And one of their main strategies for stabilizing their power is to scapegoat different groups. And one of these groups have been the poor. Others are the Roma and migrants and refugees. And these groups have been basically selected by the government, and they are being punished for everything that is happening to the country in economic terms or political terms. So there's a huge penalization of poverty in general. The welfare system has been dismantled. The whole constitutional structure of the country has been dismantled. And more importantly, there is a massive redistribution of wealth towards wealthy people and towards the upper middle class. So a lot of the subsidies and a lot of state support and a lot of state money now goes to the top 10 or 20% of society, and the money is being taken away from the poorest members of society. So in terms of homelessness, visible homelessness is only just the tip of the iceberg, as I think everywhere. I would say that there is a housing crisis in Hungary, and the title of my dissertation was The Long Housing Crisis, because I think there has been a housing crisis for a very long time, but now it's really acute. And there is an estimate that between 1.5 and 3 million people live in housing poverty, which means that they live in insecure, inadequate, or no housing at all. So up to 3 million people in Hungary, in a country of 10 million. And just to add to that, around 40% of the country lives below the subsistence minimum, which is the rate of survival, like of kind of civilized survival compared to the standard of living in Hungary. And so out of these millions of people, last year there were around 40,000 people who experienced homelessness over the year. It doesn't mean that at any one point 40,000 people are homeless, but they did experience being without a home and turning to social services for help with their housing last year. So we are talking about a lot of people. And now I will talk a little bit about how the state responds to the housing crisis. The most important thing, I think, how the state responds to it is that the state doesn't think that there is a housing crisis. The state thinks that everything is fine. And that it's the people who are homeless who are responsible for their situation because they are criminals, they are lazy, and they don't want to integrate and they don't want to work. So that's how the state responds. But in terms of institutional responses, there is a really a pretty broad homeless shelter system, which is really dangerous because a lot of funds are used to maintain this homeless shelter system. And this is used as a kind of excuse by the government. They are saying that they are doing everything they can by funding these shelters, but there is no exit from these shelters. It's only for emergencies. And a big majority of people who enter this shelter system will never leave it. So they either die as they live there, or they are just circulating between different kinds of institutions, but there is basically no way for them to leave this system. Then there is a very high level of stigmatization. Homeless people are very often called criminals or equaled with criminals in public discourse. And there were years, especially in from 2011 to 2013, when homeless people were really being exploited for political capital by the government. And this changed only when the refugee crisis came to Hungary, because then refugees replaced homeless people or poor people as the group that can be blamed for all the ills of our country. Very importantly, there is a very high level of criminalization too. So Hungary is the only country that has in its constitution the criminalization of homelessness. So our constitution says that living in public spaces is a criminal offense and that laws can be passed to criminalize people who live on streets. And of course, in addition to this legal kind of discrimination, there is the more practical side of it, which is there is a lot of harassment on the streets by the authorities, and the rights of homeless people are very rarely respected by authorities. And it's important that the criminalization of homelessness is part of a bigger trend of criminalization, which is directed towards especially Roma people and poor people in general, and people who just don't fit in this idea of an ideal white Christian Hungarian family. The government, ever since the regime change, regardless of their political orientation, whether they call themselves socialist or not, think that housing is a private issue. And this is basically an ideological reaction to the fact that it was such a central issue under state socialism. So now every government in power in Hungary thinks that if they embrace housing as a public issue, they will be labeled communists. So they have a really high stake in not embracing housing as a public issue, as something that the state has to intervene to provide to people. The last point that I want to make is that I said that there are no, so housing subsidies were reduced to a minimum. But this is only partially true, because actually only housing subsidies for poor and low-income people were reduced to a minimum. The amount of money that the state spends on the housing of rich people is a lot. There has been a lot of support for home ownership and for subsidized interest rates and for subsidized mortgages. And now there's a new program of the government that if you promise to have a lot of children, you will get basically free money from the government to build your own home. So the government is using housing and housing subsidies to have this very kind of cynical population policy to boost the Hungarian population. And this money is going to those people who can actually build like family homes, which in Hungary is not necessarily the most effective way of living somewhere, instead of, for example, buying apartments that are already there and nobody's using them. So it's not only in the other policies of the government that they are redistributing resources from the poor to the rich, but housing is a very, very central area where this is happening. So this was the part about how the state reacts to the housing crisis. And now I will talk about how civil society responds to the housing crisis. First of all, as I told you, there are a lot of shelters and charity organizations run by nonprofit organizations that provide some kind of services or charity or help for homeless people. Most of them are funded by the state, so they are really dependent on the central government and local governments, and all they do is they basically warehouse homeless people, which is at one level really important because they ensure their biological survival. So they give them food and clothes and they give them shelter, but they are really, through their operation, they are really stabilizing the system where all the money is just spent on warehousing, but no real solutions. And it's really difficult to get these NGOs to voice any kind of criticism of the government or any kind of criticism of the way the housing crisis is handled, because they are really afraid for their clients. So they are very afraid of making criticisms because they are afraid that they will lose their funding and that then people will really have nowhere to go and nowhere to eat. Then there is a lot of individual charity. I think more and more Hungarians are becoming more and more sensitive to this issue that there is a housing crisis. So there are a lot of initiatives for people to donate to individual homeless people or homeless families or families in housing problems. And I think on the one hand, this is a really good thing because this shows a development of organic solidarity where people actually recognize the humanity of others and they realize that there is a housing crisis, but it's really not solving the problem in a structural way. And then there are more and more grassroots and more collective and more critical kind of responses. And here I will focus on the work of one organization which I have been involved in. And after describing what the Cities for All is doing, I would like to talk a little bit about how we are building a movement, because I think one group or one organization, it's really nice to have it. And I think it's really important the work we do. But if we stay alone, we will never actually achieve what we are really fighting for. So a few words about the Cities for All. So this group was formed in 2009 after, as Colleen said, after we met Picture the Homeless, and four of us who founded this group, we used to be members of Men on the Street, which was a really middle class, very nice activist organization fighting for the right to housing. But there were really no homeless people in it, or no one was affected by housing poverty. We were all office workers and university students, and we felt that it was our obligation to protect homeless people and people who were being threatened by eviction. But it was not really, it was an empowering project for us, but it didn't really challenge power relations as they were. So then in 2007, I came to the US and I met Picture the Homeless, and then I realized that everything that we had been doing before was just kind of a preparation or a critical consciousness development for us as middle-class activists, but that we have to move on and kind of engage in a different kind of model. So then we formed the Cities for All, which is a kind of hybrid organization. We were inspired by Picture the Homeless, who came to Hungary and trained us, but we are using a different kind of model than they are. And our members are homeless, formerly homeless, or living in housing poverty. And housing poverty we define in a very broad way: anybody who has debts on their housing, or who can't pay for their bills, or anybody who lives in social housing, anybody who lives in with their family members, anybody who lives in a sublet without a contract or a sublet without an address. So anybody who has any kind of difficulties with their housing, and of course all of them struggle with economic difficulties, so all of our affected members are basically poor. And then we have the ally members, who I think many of them do also have issues with their housing. A lot of them live in sublets or with their families, or they need support from their families to live wherever they live, but they have a lot more cultural capital, and they have they definitely belong to the middle class, or maybe even to the intellectual class. And I think these are the resources that we are bringing to the group. So homeless and housing poor people bringing the issues that they are facing and the kind of anger and experience that they have. And then the ally members, who bring all their education abroad and in Hungary and all their connections and all their knowledge and policy things. And then we combine these two kinds of experiences and knowledge. And we try to work in a very unhierarchical and very democratic way. So there is no such thing as organizers. Like, I'm not organizing homeless people. I'm working in a group where everybody is an activist, whether they are homeless or not. And we work together to create an organization and to create a movement. And this cross-class kind of work is really important for us, and it's really important for us that we try to minimize all kinds of hierarchies and that we educate ourselves and we reflect on this continuously, how to take have all the resources that allies have and transfer them to all the affected members and how to empower them so that we are on an equal footing and then we can really fight side by side as comrades. Right now we have more than 100 members, but of course not all of them are active, as I'm sure it's true for all of your organizations. We have around 30-40 active members, 90% of whom are affected by housing poverty, and we also have a team of 10 lawyers that I will talk about later. We see homelessness as a very complex issue. We think it's a social, economic, and political issue, and we think it's an issue of humanity. We think that everybody's affected by homelessness in a sense, or will be affected, or is potentially affected. So we think that it's for people to have a home, it's a question of being a human being, at least at this stage of history. It's not it's a minimum that you don't even have to bring like rational arguments for, but we think that as a human being you are entitled to a safe and healthy and stable and affordable home. We are very explicitly a political organization, so we are not a charity, not a service organization. We are fighting for structural changes, and we think that the solution to homelessness is a political solution. And we, for us, our main target is the state, the national and the local state, because what we see is that Hungary is a rich country in the sense that it's if you take the world, it's among the like one third richest countries in the world. Of course, in the European Union, it's among the poorest countries, but this country does have enough resources to house everyone in a dignified way. So we are targeting and we think that is the state that is not using these resources properly. So what we are doing is we are trying to challenge the state to have structures and policies where everybody's entitled to housing. And we are not talking about the individual right to housing, but we are talking about social systems that ensure that everybody has the right to housing. Very much like education or healthcare in Hungary. If you are a person in Hungary, you don't even have to be a citizen. You are entitled to education and healthcare. And we think housing is in the same category as education and healthcare. And of course, we could talk about those too. Those have very, very big issues, and they are, you know, they are being taken away from us, and people are fighting for that. But housing is not even part of that category that is considered a universal right, but in the sense of a universal system that everybody is entitled to. So some of the activities that we have, we do a lot of individual advocacy, which does bring a lot of problems with it, because this, you know, in the eyes of a lot of people, this turns us into a service organization. So for example, we have between 500 and 1,000 people coming to us every year asking for help. I will be evicted from the shelter, or I will be evicted from my home, or the bank is chasing me, or the police are harassing me, help me, do something. And we actually do help in the sense that we have accumulated so many resources and so many tools over the years that we can actually help people. We can actually help people prevent their eviction, and we can help them take their issues to court if they want to, or we can actually help them stay in their shelters when they would be evicted. So we do a lot of individual engagement with people, but of course whenever we are in contact with these people, we try to bring them in. We try to get them to become activists. It's really difficult, and people are really preoccupied with their own problems. So this is one of our big challenges, how to turn clients into activists. Or politicians, or, you know, political citizens. Then we do a lot of awareness raising, which I really don't like this word, but we think that in order for the government and the country to react to the housing crisis, they actually have to know that there's a housing crisis. So what we know is we have this constant talk about the housing crisis, even this term, we repeat it wherever we talk, we repeat it over and over again, so that it actually enters people's minds and people start talking about the housing crisis. And one of the things that we do is we organize the Vacant Buildings March, which is in Hungary, there are around 300,000 empty housing units. In Budapest, which is a city of 2 million, we have 50,000 empty housing units. So this is a lot of housing that is not being used for people to live in. So we don't think that the solution is simply to take homeless people and then put them into housing. It doesn't necessarily work like this, but we use vacant buildings as a mobilizing tool, because it's very easy for people to imagine that, oh, there are people on the street and then there are empty homes. Let's do something about it. So we use the vacant buildings as a kind of metaphor or as a tool to make people understand that there is something wrong with redistribution. Things are not working properly. And then we also have long-term campaigns, mostly about around issues that are identified by our members or by people who come to us asking for help. Whenever somebody comes to us to ask for help, we try to think whether their issue is a strategic issue, it's a long-term issue, whether it's something that affects more people. If it is, then we, in most cases, we develop a campaign around it. So some of the campaigns that we have right now, or we have had in the past, is the criminalization of homelessness. So our number one campaign is to get this law out of the constitution that criminalizes homelessness. It's a very difficult fight, and I'm not saying that we have been winning it, but it's a question of principle for us that we don't want to live in a country that has no housing policy but criminalizes people living on the street. Then we have a campaign around police harassment, which is very similar to stop and frisk here, although there is no frisk in Hungary. So people are stopped, just the police stops them and asks for their ID for no reason. And we have had this really long campaign around trying to get the police to stop this practice, stopping homeless people just because they look homeless, or stopping poor people just because they are poor. And this issue is becoming big in Hungary. Now Roma organizations are also stepping up around this issue. So I think there will be a combination of, very similarly to New York, there will be in the coming years a combination of this issue of how the police are interacting with citizens. Then we deal a lot with issues of registered address. In Hungary, the basis of your citizenship is your official address. If you have no address, or if your address doesn't correspond to where you actually live, you can basically not exercise any of your rights, or even get your child to school, or get healthcare, or vote, or anything. And this affects hundreds of thousands of people, actually. So we have a big issue, we have a big campaign around the addresses, and especially now we will concentrate on children without address. There are around 4,000 children in Hungary who are without any kind of address, which means that they are basically non-existent for any kind of social or healthcare system. Then we have a campaign around children taken away from their families because of homelessness, which is, of course, prohibited by law, because we did join the UN's Children's Declaration of Rights or whatever, which says that children can't be taken away from their families because of poverty. But it does happen that whenever there is an eviction, the child welfare authority is there to take the children away from the family, instead of the housing department being there rehousing the family. So it's a very typical issue. When people lose their homes, they lose their children. And once their children are taken away, it's really difficult to get them back. And then we have a lot of local struggles, especially in Budapest, especially in the 8th district, which is a gentrifying district, and the local government has this huge wave of evictions against people who live in social housing, and we try to stop these evictions, or at least try to negotiate a solution for people to be relocated on their terms if those buildings are being demolished. And as you could see so far, we use a big combination of different methods. Or approaches. I don't think we have I don't think we are settled on one approach of how to do this. We do use community organizing. We try to organize people around issues because we think that's the easiest way to tap them into what we are doing. And with these local struggles, we do door knocking, and we do community forums, and we try to bring people around, like local identities. We also do a lot of legal advocacy and casework. We represent people in court, or we write a lot of letters to different authorities and courts, and our lawyers, and I will talk about this a little bit later, are starting to develop proposals for new legislation. So we are trying to do legal advocacy not only at the individual level, but at the national or local level, to trying to change actual laws. We engage in a lot of kind of activist things, radical actions or direct actions like eviction blocks or occupations. When we occupy vacant buildings, we don't occupy them, or so far we have not occupied them for our members to live there, because they haven't really made up their minds if they want to do that. But we occupy them to call attention to the issues and to try to corner local governments into action, or trying to put pressure on them. But we do a lot of eviction blocks when we try to stop people from being evicted, and a lot of them work because local governments hate bad publicity, and because we have managed to create this impression of us that we are very big and dangerous, which of course we believe is true, but these radical actions also help to reinforce that image. We do a lot of communications. We have really good relationship with the mainstream media. We try to make our actions media friendly, so that they can actually have good footage and interesting. They can create interesting shows, and it's really important for us. And we have sustain these personal relationships with people in the media, and we try to get them to discuss our topics instead of other topics. And we always try to pressure them to invite people from our group to talk about housing issues. And we also use a lot of social media. In Hungary, Facebook is really, really popular. The other kinds of social media are not so much, but we use a lot of, we do talk to the middle class, because usually these are often used by middle class citizens. We do a lot of public and popular education. We have our own academy, which is basically courses for our own members in different topics, from the English language through how to use a computer to civil disobedience and gender inequality. So we do a lot of just self-education. And then a lot of these courses are open to the public, and we try to, and the public, when we talk about the public, we talk about homeless and housing poor people. So we always mobilize and target our activities to people who are affected, because it would be really easy to bring in middle-class activists, but we don't want them to flood the organization, because that way our power balance would really be off. Okay, and then we are trying to build a movement, which I will talk about in a second. I just wanted to list a few of our achievements, because I think that's pretty important, like some of the things that we think we have been successful at. One of the things is, I think that we have managed to put the housing crisis on the political agenda, which is a huge thing, because it was a taboo for 20 years, more or less, after the regime change. And not with the central government or the governing party, but all the other parties that are not in government right now, they never had a housing program for the elections. Now they all have one. And all the progressive politicians are competing with each other, talking about homelessness and talking about the housing crisis and trying to do something about it. And of course, we know when you are in the opposition, it's easy. But we also think that by this, we are building this political capital that once they get into power, we can actually hold them accountable, or we can actually hold them to their previous promises and previous rhetoric. That, remember, when you were in opposition, you actually agreed with us and you thought that there was a housing crisis, so now let's do something about it. And we did manage to achieve a few changes especially in local politics. Also, I think the fact that housing is now on the agenda, a lot of these small grassroots groups are starting, which are all related to housing somehow. A lot of them are charity organizations, but they all, I think, have been inspired by us in one way or the other, so they really respect the political work we are doing. So there is not necessarily a very clear or rigid divide between the people who cook at home and then distribute it to homeless people and us, and they are really happy to distribute our flyers and to cook for our demonstrations and to post our events. So I think there is this really good interaction between these more charity-like grassroots groups and our more political work. And it's really important, because these organizations also create encounters between different classes of people, so they actually get to know each other. Then we did manage to force a Housing First program to start in one district of Budapest. So now we have an association that we established has a contract with one local government in Budapest for a housing program for homeless people for the next 5 years, which is a big deal. And it's not a lot of homes, it's two social housing units a year, but these are all housing units that have been formerly vacant, and then we renovate them with homeless people and they can move in. And this is, we are using it as a model to try to convince other local governments to start the same things. We managed to prevent dozens of evictions from apartments and from shacks in forests or in the woods, and this is a big thing. I think we managed to prevent the evictions of many, many families and many, many individuals. We also won a victory in court for shack dwellers, people who build their own homes in the woods. The local government bulldozed the shacks of six homeless people, and without any written notice or any kind of warning or anything. And we actually won in court, and they got compensation from the local government. And it's very interesting because this one court case was enough to stop basically all shack demolitions ever since then. So local governments are like, okay, it's better not to touch these shacks because we don't want to get into all the legal complications of bulldozing them. So at least they are letting them stay there, which is not a big thing, but at least, you know, the homes they built are safe. We also had a victory in court against the police regarding harassment. This is an ongoing thing. The court and the police actually acknowledged that this kind of discriminatory ID checks, this practice exists and that it has to be changed. But of course we won, and now the police are not doing anything that they signed in this kind of consent decree. So now we will have to, I think, move beyond legal means and just do more direct action kinds of things to actually force them to do what they promised. Then we also managed to reach what we call a moratorium on evictions in one district in Budapest. So they stopped for 6 months all evictions in this 88 district. And they, over these 6 months, they are renegotiating the contracts and everything with all the residents who are threatened with eviction. So that's also a big deal for us, because this is happening right now. So this is giving us time to organize them and also to make sure that there is change in the local legislation so that this moratorium can be extended maybe longer. And we did achieve some changes in legislation around the social services. Homeless people there was this really restrictive law that a homeless person could use only one drop-in center a day. And if they went into one drop-in center, for example, to take a shower, they couldn't go into another one to eat, because the government didn't want homeless people wandering around the streets and they wanted them to stay in one place. And we managed to change this law, and now they can, which is again, like, you know, not a big achievement, but it's something we, at least homeless people are free to use as many drop-in centers a day as they can. And then the final part of my presentation is about building a movement. So I think for years, we were really happy about our work and we really felt that we are growing and we are getting power, more and more powerful. And the media celebrates us and people, you know, we get a lot of positive comments, of course, a lot of critiques too. But I think after a while we realized that we are in a vacuum. Like if we are just fighting alone and there is no real movement around us, there is no fabric of political work around us, we will feel really good about doing our work, but the structural changes will not really happen. And so what we do to build a movement is, first, we try to, and this is a very difficult thing, and I'm sure the Cairo Center people know how difficult it is. So we try to bring together all kinds of organizations who work around housing, from policy to charity to shelter, volunteer, professional, and we try to get them to form a common agenda or a common platform. They don't even have to formally cooperate. We only want them to agree on a few basic principles so that when we all work towards that. This is really difficult. And there is some, it's happening, but it's really, really slow. And I think it's slower than it should be. Also, I think it's really important that we try to see all the different organizations that work around housing as valuable. We try not to not to talk badly necessarily about charity organizations or shelters. We do articulate our criticisms, but we always try to also express that what they are doing is useful or valuable, and that what they are doing is really good for our homeless activists, for example, because they give us shelter, but that they also should have a more structural approach. We are trying to build a mass base. So we are trying to mobilize people who are directly or indirectly affected by the housing crisis. And we do talk about, we often say, we have signs in our demonstrations that say, we are fighting for your housing too, which is trying to show that this is not, we are not, that our homeless members are not fighting for their particular roof over their particular heads, but we are actually fighting for a society where housing is available for everyone. And then we also try to create solidarity with other groups, and we try to get them to, we try to push their agenda, and we try to get them to push our agenda, housing. So we have a lot of common, not only events, but discussions with Roma groups and migrants' rights groups and LGBTQ groups. These are the groups that, where we are more successful, as they, a lot of them have integrated housing into their work, and we are doing a lot of things to promote their agenda. So we are always there at the Pride parade in Budapest, and we are always very, very open about our solidarity with all of these groups, and we attend each other's demonstrations, and there are also some strategic discussions around how we should cooperate. And then the last thing we do is we actually started to build, so since we didn't really manage to get the already existing organizations to join our platform of housing, we started to build our own organizations. And first, I think this was a like self-defense mechanism, because we felt that so much of the work we do was starting to turn into service providing, like renovating social housing and giving people legal advice, that it was endangering us being a political organization. So then we decided that we should create all these different, we should launch all these different organizations that take, that we basically outsource service provision and legal work, and also education to organizations that we established who follow our strategy, who think that our, like, who share the basic ideology of our work, but who also have their own individual identities, and who can then take, like, expand our work and make us more powerful in a way that doesn't endanger our political activism. So we have, so at the center of this, like, small grassroots empire, as we like to call it, or this octopus, is the Cities for All, which is, you know, homeless, housing poor people and their allies, and we do the political work. We are very confrontational. We are not afraid of getting into conflicts, and we like to kind of enhance crisis situations into political opportunities. Then there is this organization that we grew out of ourselves, which is From the Street to Housing, and they are a housing first organization. All the people who work there, you used to be or are still on members, who are social workers, and they are the ones who go to the local governments and renovate empty social housing, and then they help people stay in the social housing. So our job is to get the local government to agree to give us social housing, and then the moment they say yes, it's this other association that takes over the nice kind of work and the cooperative kind of work, and then they cooperate with the local government. So this way, we don't have to compromise in our tactics or in our methods. And whenever the local government does not keep its promises, then the association lets us know, and then we are there again protesting and, you know, holding them accountable. So there is this back and forth, like good cop, bad cop. And it has worked really well. Then there is the Street Lawyer, which is another organization that grew out of us. It's a team of more than 10 lawyers, all of them volunteers, and they are giving legal advice individually to homeless and housing poor people, but now they are also formed an association, and now they will start pursuing legislative changes, which is a big thing. I mean, they will start working on a new law about registering addresses, a new law about the right to housing, a new law about public toilets. So all the work, all the kind of professional knowledge that we didn't have, they will word these laws, but it's our job to create the political conditions to have these laws passed. So again, we work together. They are the nice ones who will negotiate with the ministries and who will negotiate with the politicians, but we will be the ones organizing the demonstrations, and we will be the ones mobilizing people who are affected by these problems. So it's again this back and forth, and we think that it makes us much stronger to have them. They have our back, but we are the ones setting the agenda. So their strategy always follows ours and never the other way around. And then there is the last organization, the fourth of this group of organizations, which is the School of Public Life, of which I was a co-founder. And that is more about education, because what we realized is that a lot of people really like what we do in Hungary, but a lot of people also think that we are kind of aliens or UFOs in the Hungarian political spectrum, that we do things that, Hungarians are not so brave, Hungarians are not so radical, in Hungary you can't do this, people are passive. So we think that in order for the Cities for All and organizations like the Cities for All to succeed, we have to have organizations that create the culture, the political culture that is needed for us to be successful and to be recognized. So in the School of Public Life, what we do is we take the model of the Cities for All and we take other experiences and we teach as many people from other oppressed groups as possible about these methods, and we try to create, basically it's a form of base building. We are building a base for ourselves in the Cities for All, but we are also helping other groups to have their own Cities for All. And we think that if all kind of oppressed groups or different groups who experience some kind of exclusion had their own Cities for All, we would be at least one step ahead, and all of us would be much stronger. Then this way, when it's everybody just like, it's great that you are doing, but the Roma can't do this. It's impossible. The Roma are able to do this. They just have to learn how to do this. And it's true for all other groups that are experiencing exclusion. So I think this is all that I wanted to share with you. And I know this was really fast, and I think I talked really fast, but I hope it was clear. And now it's time for questions.
Yeah, and we have some good questions. Cool. Thank you so much. That was really great. Let me see. I'm going to join Tessa here. And a few questions came in as you were speaking, and so they refer to various parts of the conversation. The first was from Hector. And he asked, when you were talking about the various components of the organization and the types of things that you do, are there enough resources to help everyone who asks? And if not, how do you handle that?
That's interesting. I'm not sure. I mean, I feel that there are resources or our people. So we are an organization that doesn't even have like a regular office. There is a room that we use, and when we need it, we use it. But we don't have paid staff, and we don't have an office, and we don't have things. So what we have is people. So I think our resources are a little bit like a breathing creature. Like when we need more resources, we start pulling in more people, and then we don't need so many resources, then we get a little bit smaller. So I think, for example, when there, like, these issues come up mostly when, for example, in March, there are many, many evictions in Hungary, because you can't evict people during the winter, but in March, the government can start evicting them, so they start to evict them immediately, and then it can happen that there are 10 people asking us to do eviction blocks on a week. Well, we don't have resources for that. We are just too small. So what we try to do is we use our different contacts and different other organizations and different knowledges and different ways to slow on down, make the other one, we try to mobilize as many outside resources and inside resources that we can address all of them, at least in a certain way. If only with legal advice, then with legal advice. We can't do eviction blocks for 10 families, that's for sure. So we try to give them something, and we try to give them something that is useful for them. But with the level of the housing crisis, it's not possible to stop every single eviction. If that's the question, yes, we don't have the resources. But otherwise, we always try to mobilize whatever we have in a way that everybody gets something. Some kind of help.
So building on that question, Kareem asks, on the same note, are ally members with jobs in government or welfare agencies able to use those resources as a recruitment tool without risking their jobs, i.e. their access to those resources? Or are there better ways to provide resources? So is there that kind of relationship
with the
people resources that you were talking about? Are any of those people social service providers or in government positions?
No. I mean, we did have a few of our members who worked as social workers, and they did have, like, some of them were threatened. Their bosses were saying that if I see you again on TV at this eviction block, you will lose your job. And actually, that was one of the, like, I think that was one of the, I wouldn't say motivations behind establishing this association from street to housing, which now basically gives work to our members who are social workers. So we basically saved them from these organizations, and we created a workplace for them so that they actually do the work that they like to do, but they can also be independent from the official structures. And this way they are, you know, using their occupation, social work, but to further movement means and not service provider means. So I think that's what we need. In other cases, most of our ally members, they do organize their lives around the cities for all, so they try to take jobs that are in no conflict or that are so independent that they can have as much time for the cities for all as they can, and also that their income is not, or they are not dependent on anyone, or their income is not dependent on people that may get in conflict with.
This question is from Hector. What strategies have you used to recruit homeless people to organize them? How do you stay in touch? Many organizations in the U.S. do not organize homeless people as they are transient and hard to get in touch with.
Oh, interesting. I mean, we have been primarily a homeless organization up until maybe 2 years ago, when we actually told ourselves that in order to address this issue, we have to start recruiting housing to housing poor too. But for the first 5 years of our existence, we only basically recruited homeless people. And then we started to recruit all kinds of people with all kinds of housing issues. How we recruit, we have a lot of techniques, and I wouldn't say any of them are really successful. I mean, this is our biggest challenge, recruitment and mobilization, and our experiences is that if you get in touch with 100 people, maybe 2 will actually join the organization, but then those 2 will be really committed. So we are always, and we always try to think that whoever is here is more important than everyone else who is not here. So we have to really appreciate those who actually joined us than the 98 other people who decided not to join us. We do a lot of forums, like we go to homeless shelters or public spaces and we give presentations about different topics, or we show movies and then we discuss them, or we hold trainings and then we try to get people to stay. We just started this self-help group of people threatened with eviction, because so many of them came to us for help that we thought that we didn't have enough resources to help them. So we thought that if we create a self-help group, they will learn to help each other, and then hopefully we can politicize them through that helping and then bring them into our organization. But at every demonstration, we have a table where you can sign up, and you have homeless people can play quizzes about homelessness, and we have all these. So we, with every event, so in our group, we have 2 recruitment coordinators, 2 people who are, their only job at any event that we have is to recruit people. So talk to them, be nice to them, get their contact, invite them to our meetings. So, and with every event, we have a recruitment strategy. So how do we get our own members to attend? That's also the responsibility of the recruitment coordinator. And then how do we get the people that we have met over the years to attend? We have these big databases of everyone that we have had in contact with. And then how to get the bigger public to attend. So we are thinking in these layers. And then how we stay in touch? Most of our members now have access to email, which is a big deal. And we don't ever like actively ask for donations. There are 3 kinds of donations that we actively ask for: reading glasses, laptops, and cell phones. And so we have a lot of these objects And whenever we have a new member, our first thing is, do you have a cell phone? If you don't, we give one to you and we get you a SIM card and we set up an email address for you. And we have a course, a computer course. So we really try to get people hooked, get access to all the technology, because we have a listserv where we discuss a lot of things. But we have a rule that we can't make decisions online. So even though everybody should have a cell phone and everybody should have an email address, we never make any decisions online. And we have around 10 meetings a week. We have a big group and we have the working groups and we have the special meetings and we have the strategic meetings. And so decisions can only be made there in person. So and if you are not there, bad luck. So decisions can be reversed just because somebody wasn't there. It's like, you, if you want to take part, if you want to determine what's happening in the organization, you have to be there at the meetings. So I think people know that the stakes are really high. And whenever we have an important meeting, the recruitment coordinators are actually responsible for getting people to that meeting. So we send text messages to everyone, we send emails to everyone, we invite them personally. So we put a lot of effort into moving around our own bodies, like getting ourselves to our own meetings and discussing there in person.
So this question comes from Aaron, who asks, says, one of the obstacles we encounter in our work in rural Washington State is that many poor white people have internalized the idea that immigrants and refugees are taking jobs and resources away from them and are causing their poverty. Have you had to deal with this, and what worked best in overcoming it?
Yeah, this is really difficult. I think it's a very interesting phenomenon. In Hungary, before the refugee crisis, there were basically no migrants. I mean, very, very few, or no migrants who looked different from us. So very few migrants from Africa or Asia. So up until 2 years ago, the only way the issue of migration came up for homeless people is, I'm not sure if you know about this, but there's a huge Hungarian minority in Romania, which is a country bordering us. And a lot of Hungarians from Romania come to Hungary to work. And some of them become homeless. And as they are European Union citizens, they have access to shelters. So I have heard on a few occasions, very weird anti-Romanian remarks. Anti-Romanian remarks are actually about Hungarians who come from Romania, which is very interesting, because in the national imagination, they are often portrayed as the real Hungarians because they live in a minority position and they still keep their language. But in the minds of poor people, they often appear as the migrants who take our jobs and who take our shelter places. And then came the refugee crisis, and that was difficult because the government had a really, really strong anti-refugee campaign. And I think and there was a huge wave of solidarity in Hungary for these refugees, a lot of food distribution, clothes distribution. A lot of the institutions that were providing help to homeless people were transformed into institutions for refugees. And homeless people really resented this, that, you know, before that I could go there and take a shower and get food, but now there are all these refugees doing it, and where should I go, and why are they? And they really felt very, I think, offended by the wave of solidarity, because they felt that there are all these foreigners and now all the Hungarians come out and love them, and what's happening to us? We have been here always and they never came to our help. So I think that there has been resentment, and one way we are trying to deal with this is talk about it, but also as an organization, we did support all kinds of struggles for refugees, right? So I think we are trying to educate ourselves. And just last week, there was this roundtable discussion with a refugee organization and our organization where we talked about housing issues that affect refugees and homeless people. And I think it was a really good way for our members to learn about this, because they don't necessarily know that most refugees in Hungary become homeless. And it's not because they want to be homeless or because they want to take away anybody's shelter beds, it's because they have no way of getting access to housing. So I think this is very difficult, and I have felt that this is a big issue, and I think our only response is self-education. And also we did join a lot of the demonstrations in support of refugees and through these activities, we are hoping that our members will understand that it's structural problems, that it's not the, that they should blame the individuals, but that they should understand that the homelessness of refugees is, or the poverty of refugees has the same roots as ours. But I'm not saying that we have solved this, or that I think the majority of homeless people have hold grudges against migrants and refugees. Maybe our members are a little bit different, but I'm not sure they are very, very different in their views.
Thanks. So another question for Aaron, from Aaron, is what kind of relationship do you have with religious organizations?
None. In Hungary, you can't really do anything with churches. They are really nasty. It's really difficult to say. We have, for example, on the issue of the criminalization of homelessness, we tried to reach out to Catholic priests, and we either didn't get an answer, or they told us that they think public order is more important, that they don't want homeless people to be on the street, so they agree with the legislation. But the Catholic Church in Hungary is really, I don't even know what kind of word to use. It's like really backward. Like when Pope Francis asked Catholic churches all over the world to support refugees, a lot of Hungarian priests were saying, "Well, Pope Francis is not living in Hungary. He has no idea what's happening. So we are not going to open churches to refugees because." So that's the Catholic Church. There are a few. For example, there is the Santo Egidio. Maybe it's like a small Catholic group who they give food to homeless people, and they have always supported our demonstrations, which is good. And we really like them and we really appreciate them, but they are a really, really small minority group within the Catholic Church. I'm not sure if they have any influence. The Krishna worshippers, they give out a lot of food to homeless people, and although they never openly engage in politics, but they always supported us. So but they are again like a pretty marginal group in Hungary. And then a few progressive rabbis have stood up, but very, very few. And most of the Jewish establishment doesn't really care about, I think, poverty or any of these things. So, but also you have to know that like 50% in Hungary say that they are not religious or they have nothing to do with religion. So Hungary is a very non-religious country, and I think this is partly due to state socialism when religion was just not allowed. So people kind of gave up. And I think there are more and more, especially young people, are pushing a more progressive agenda, especially in the Jewish community, but in the evangelical community, which I think is Lutheran maybe here. I'm not sure about the different names, but there is one kind of Protestantism where they are becoming more and more and socially conscious. So I think there is a change, but it's a very small, slow change and a very small change. And there is a basic problem that most Hungarians have been socialized to reject religion under state socialism. So it's difficult, I think, for these churches to approach them on a religious or a moral basis.
So a question from Lauren, who's out of Nashville, Tennessee. She said, I'd be interested to hear more about the transition or total restart from man in the street to city is for all. Also the politicization efforts with members. Do people make commitments of solidarity when they receive support with direct action, et cetera? And is there a regular program or curriculum that builds this political education and buy-in? Mm-hmm.
So men on the street and cities for all. Yeah, that's more like a personal journey, I think, for me. I got interested in the issue of homelessness because of my research as a cultural anthropologist in 2002, when I started doing research about this program of the mayor of Budapest, who tried to clean the cities of the city from homeless people, graffiti, and illegal vendors. And I was interested in the in the social construction of purity or cleanliness. It was a totally theoretical interest. And then when I found this initiative of the mayor, I started to think about, with my co-researcher, we started to think about how this whole idea of cleanliness is used as a tool of political exclusion and oppression. And then we did research for like 3 or 4 years. And then when we finished the research, I felt so angry that these things are happening in my city, that people are being pushed out in the name of being dirty, that I actually started looking for an activist organization, Men on the, and where I could use my knowledge. And then I found Men on the Street, and I joined them, and I started to bring in new topics. And I think that was my birth as a citizen, when I actually realized that as an anthropologist, my role is not only to document what's happening, but actually, if I don't like it, I have the right or I have the obligation to change it. So I think, and I think for most of us, that's why that organization was good, because we actually, or it was our political education that we experienced ourselves as citizens, which is a big deal, because in post-socialist Hungary, young people are not really politicized. So I think it was a good thing after all, but it was a very patronizing or paternalistic thing. I mean, people came to us for help and we were like, oh, we have to help because we are middle class and they are not, and we have to go there and stop the evictions. But it was, I think it was the only organization around housing, so it was still a big deal. But then I think when I came to the US, it just dawned on me when I was listening, when I saw all these activists of Picture the Homeless, like black homeless activists who were talking about Marx and oppression and liberation. And I just realized that something is wrong with what we are doing in Hungary. Where are all these people? Like, I've never met these, I never talked to anyone. Like, I've never talked to a homeless person in my life. I'm just really outraged that they are being pushed around. So I think it was more like a personal development for me, which took so many years. I don't know why it had to take so many years, but it took so many years. And then it just dawned on me that what we have been doing was really only good for us. And then we Men on the Street was, it went apart. I mean, we stopped it. And then I think it was my idea that we should bring Picture the Homeless to Hungary and show homeless people there what homeless people are capable of, that they are actually able to organize themselves, and that our job is more to create the infrastructure for that organization, or to use whatever resources we have to support that. And it was I think it was an instant click, and it was an instant click for all of the other activists that I invited to do this together with. And it was interesting to see, because it was obvious that it was a historical moment, because when we put out the call for this training with Picture the Homeless in Budapest, 80 homeless people applied. So it was obvious that this kind of an organization was really necessary. It was just nobody, it had to be someone who came to New York who had this idea, but I have always felt that it was a historical necessity for us to change from one organization to the other. It just took us a really long time to realize this. And about the political education curriculum, we do have a curriculum, but every 6 months we have this strategic retreat where we discuss our strategy, and there people, that's where we discuss the curriculum for the next 6 months. So we always plan ahead, and whatever our members need, we organize a training around it. So from taking notes to the facilitation of discussions, some people want yoga, so we have yoga. It really depends on the needs of our members, both ally and affected members. Like, now people have become really interested in these collective financing mechanisms, that unions use, because a lot of our members have a lot of financial troubles. So now we have all these trainings or all these like presentations about how people pool money and then help each other out. And then a lot of these things, they are first educational, but then we realize that we want to develop something out of it. So then we work it into our strategy, and then the School of Public Life does have a set curriculum for each semester, which is also kind of coordinated with the Cities for All. So all those trainings of the Cities for All that can be useful for outsiders are usually organized by the School of Public Life, because there we can give people support for travel and give them food because we have more money and things like that. So we can open it up, and it's not only our own members, but anybody can. can join.
Well, thank you very much. Our time is drawing close to an end. Is there a way for people to follow? What's the best way for people to follow your work from here? You have an English language website?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we do have English stuff. I mean, I try to have most of our major actions translated into English, and we have a Facebook page. Very rarely we post in English, but since our base speaks Hungarian, we don't want to alienate them by posting in English. Yeah. But I think it's Facebook, and the website has an English section.
And
the School of Public Life definitely has an English section.
And there's a documentary that will come out next year, and at least a portion of it has been subtitled in English.
Yeah.
Will that be the case when the documentary, documentary comes
definitely.
Out? So there's a very powerful documentary about their work that I think will be really important addition to all of our libraries and all of our political education here, just showing the sort of people in action there.
And also I just remember that we have this mailing list for our international contacts, which is not a real mailing list, it's just an Excel sheet with a lot of our international contacts, but there we send all of our, you know, if we need international support or open letters, or if we have any kind of campaigns that can be interesting to people outside of Hungary. So if people are interested, I can put their email addresses on that list.
Yeah. Well, that's really great. And I know that we will continue to be in touch with this work and a part of the growing movement that is building across the globe, and necessarily a global movement. And that will take shape because we will make it take shape together. And so I hope everyone here is able to join us again. We do these webinar seminars monthly. And so stay tuned for next month's seminar, and we will continue to hear from folks like us that are trying to develop strategic thinking and trying to be a networked leadership that's making the New Poor People's Campaign for Today possible. And so please be in touch if you have ideas about that, and be sure to be on our mailing list as well. And so I hope to be in touch with everyone soon. I hope that you have a great week, and that that this is a little bit of inspiration from Tessa as we go into our work this week and beyond. So thanks everyone for being here.
Thank you.